The Football Pod with Paddy and Andy.
I remember having the argument with Jack beforehand, kind of going, Jack, if this shit doesn't work, you would have put me back out in the field and don't whip the big donkey out of full power.
Download the OTB Sports app and subscribe to the GAA podcast feed now.
OTB AM
with Gillette, proud supporters of Movember. Gentlemen, let's move.
Right, 8:05 this morning here on OTB AM. Your comments are coming in thick and fast. There's a lot of love for Michael Carrick, the player, and that's fair enough. You're a Man United fan. He was there on loads of great days. That's the crack.
Are you sure you're not like misremembering Michael Carrick and the attitude towards him as some sort of borderline ironic, as in like
no. Iniesta? No. I definitely had long, boring arguments with Man United fans at the time about how there were some, not many, who would have said that he was the perfect combination of Keane and Scholes, in that he had Keane's energy and he had Scholes' passing, and so therefore, it was a small minority, and I don't want to indulge those people too much. But I had those conversations, and they're constantly like, I remember one guy texted me 4.5 years after we'd last had a conversation after Carrick got man of the match, and some, like, they probably beat West Ham 4-0 or something, and the text was, "Still think Carrick shit." That was it. Hadn't had any conversation with this person in 4.5 years, but he waited until then, until he was a man of the match in one game. I was like, "Oh, gotcha now."
Yeah, I actually need to go back to a few people who got onto me over the course of the summer for a couple of Solskjaer takes last season. Somebody got into me over the course of the summer being like, "You said last year Hasenhüttl is an unquestionably better manager than Solskjaer. Where are you at now with that take?" I should get back to him actually and be like, "Who's still in the job, mate?"
I mean, I actually...
When he did beat Hasenhüttl 9-0, let's not forget, but I'm going to forget about that.
You would have seen Hasenhüttl linked with the job at various places as well. I mean, look, we'll see. 8:07 this morning. If you want to get in touch, 087-9180-180 is the WhatsApp number. Wherever you're watching the world, we'd love to hear from you. You can get us on YouTube. The best place to listen to us these days is, of course, the OTB Sports app. I mean, you can listen to us just as a radio show. We've got a live, continuous feed of top quality sports content all day on OTB Sports Radio. All you got to do is tell your smart speaker to play OTB Sports Radio and you should be okay. If you want to get in touch with us, of course, we'd love to hear from you. Now, time for us to turn our attention back to rugby. I'm delighted to say Louise Galvin is back with us. Louise, how are you getting on?
Good. And yourselves?
Yeah, pretty good. We're trying to temper our levels of excitement to find reasons not to be too excited after, well, really quite a swashbuckling trio of games where we never looked in any danger of losing any of the matches. We were clearly the better side in the three games. We've got strength and depth, and it's all pretty rosy. So what should we do here, Louise? Should we get carried away?
No, absolutely not. Don't get carried away. It's a job well done. It's definitely an affirmation of all those things that you've just said. We can play with different styles, I think, to win games, which is another point to add in there, because we played against Japan versus Argentina was quite different in terms of how they defended, I suppose, and how we broke them down. But definitely the idea of having a little bit more strength and depth, to have, you know, such young players coming in. And I think the main word I have for them is dynamism. They're just so dynamic. Like from the last day, obviously, the likes of Ryan Berry coming in, Dan Sheehan, I thought they were phenomenal and really took their opportunity. And it's like this new breed of rugby player that's coming up in terms of their position and their conditioning and their kind of mindset of, I'm not just going to run over the top of someone. They all have, you know, great hands and that ability to find a soft shoulder, low centre of gravity, take a step. And, you know, the work rate there is phenomenal as well. And then when you hear kind of slightly older members of the group, the more experienced members of the group, like Peter Mahan using the word fun in press conferences, you're like, whoa, we're on to something good here. But then we got to, you know, settle ourselves, because I think for all Northern Hemisphere sides, it's a case of keeping in mind that the Southern Hemisphere sides are jaded, worse than they ever are coming over November. The effect of COVID on their tours has been massive. And I think Ledesma really touched on that as well in terms of the Argentinian side, the fact none of them even play their club rugby in their own continent. So we have to kind of take that into account as well. So all in all, we've done what we needed to do, but it's still, what are we, 2 years out from a World Cup. Its position aren't at their peak, like maybe the Northern Hemisphere sides are coming into the start of the season. So we're in good stead, but nothing to get too carried away with yet.
And I think especially on that front is the way and the shape in which the Southern Hemisphere teams came up to the Northern Hemisphere, that I think there is maybe in the aftermath of the All Blacks game a bit of a caution because of what happened in 2018. But as you say, it's not even the 1 year out from the World Cup scenario from the last cycle, it's the 2 years out from the World Cup scenario, because 2017 Ireland played South Africa and smashed them. I think at halftime Brent Pope was saying this is the worst performance Ireland have ever come up against, or maybe didn't say that, but it was something quite heavy and quite on that level. And 2 years later, obviously they're World Cup champions, so that is the level that they can turn to, as much as we need to temper our own expectations.
Yeah, and it'll be a warning sign to them as well about how strong the Northern Hemisphere teams are. And it is across the board. That's one thing from the Six Nations. We're not the only form team. Like France are, oh my goodness, that game was phenomenal on Saturday night. Like Wales would be, they're right off that first game. They obviously didn't have a lot of their internationals available for the first game against New Zealand. But even just to grind out that tight win, similarly with England, Eddie Jones would be delighted. So, you know, teams are, the Northern Hemisphere teams, they're all doing pretty well. But we can't all do well and be happy come the end of Six Nations either. But I suppose it's a good starting point. And I think what I like is it wasn't that, you know, we scored a load of tries against Japan and we scored a load of tries against a jaded Argentinian side, but we just resorted to kicking a few penalties and grinding out a win against New Zealand. It's how we won the games, and it's also who we had playing, that we didn't. We had a relatively settled team, certainly in the pack, but we weren't relying on, okay, Johnny has to stay in the field. Now, if Joey didn't have such a good performance the last day, that might still be a big, I suppose, asterisk beside it, and it probably still is a little bit. I'm not sure if Ryburn really is third in line there, whether it was just more exposure to the whole site, the whole November window for him. And obviously, even with Joey's, you know, injury concerns, Joey can have them as well. So we definitely do need to even hammer home who is our third choice there, whether it is Harry Byrne or, you know, obviously he's put Jack Carty in ahead of the next guys in line to, you know, Billy Burns as the next position. So that's probably still a bit unsure. But like the competition places is phenomenal. Even when Craig Casey came on the last day, like the zip he had of the ball, he certainly didn't look out of place. Bearing in mind he's coming in behind the pack that's going forward, and you know he's probably 20 points up already when he's coming on. So all these things have a part to play in the whole context of it. But still, he does not look out of place. If I'd see him come on, if he was on the bench, you know, half an hour into that Welsh game, I wouldn't be shaking my boots. I'd be like, all right, let's see what he's made of now. But I wouldn't be overly concerned either.
Yeah, that's the level we're at now, where you would hope that there is enough strength and depth for them to be able to withstand almost any injury crisis. But we kind of got through almost until the warm-up of the Argentina game through these three games thinking, actually, we've managed our resources very well here and we're not really missing any of our players. We do know from World Cups that by the time you come out of the group stages, when you reach the quarterfinals, it's at that point that you take a look at your playing stocks and they tend to be diminished. Is there any hope maybe that we're playing a slightly less abrasive game? And that we, you know.
Yeah, I think, yeah, definitely, Joe. I think, like, even the context that we're making, like, we still had a huge amount of rucks the last year. We were over the 100 mark on ruck. I think we'd retained 103 and lost, like, 3 or something, which is an incredible stat as well. But we're not just looking for collisions. We're looking for soft shoulders. So even the manner of those rucks, they're just a little bit less abrasive. It's not all the time, but it's a lot, you know, we're trying to come in at different angles. We're not just trying to create a ruck nearly for the sake of it and retain the ball and suck numbers in. And then obviously we're not trying to do it all the time. When we get an opportunity, we're trying to offload that ball out of contact, even in quite tight situations. For example, when Matter got his yellow card, like there was just a 2 or 3 knock-ons there in that contact zone that I don't think we would have seen in the Joe Schmidt era. It's just this idea of keep the ball moving, keep changing the point of attack. It doesn't have to be 100 rucks, 120 rucks a game. So hopefully that would help a certain amount. But also I think it's a good sign that, look, those injuries happened in the run-up to the game to Henderson and Jack Cohn, and even the likes of Nick Timoney, who's not even in the squad, as Bob Belfast comes down, ends up thinking he's just warming up, then realising then getting 20 minutes of game time and does particularly well as well. So the more of these players, I think it's 52 players that Alan Farrell has capped in total, and the more of these that are kind of exposed to his system, that whole defensive system, what Mike Catt wants, then the better. Because we can see when the Interpros are playing, we do have relative strength and depth in the country, but it's at club level. Like, it's whenever an Irish squad is announced, there's always like, what about this guy? What about this guy who's generally playing well, playing week in, week out for Ulster, Munster, Connacht, whoever? Because, you know, the Leinster lads are all selected. But you know, it's exposing them. There's no point launching them, and then they need that exposure to the camps and some international game time. So even that 20 minutes the last day has been invaluable for Nick Timoney.
I know we don't know the ins and outs of Andy Farrell's contract, but there's definitely a belief that Irish rugby is incentivised at various different levels to win prize money in the Six Nations. It's very hard for him, therefore, not to pick his best team in those games. You know, you manage your resources as best you can, and we can play some kind of a second string against Italy because Italy have fallen off the face of the earth. But wouldn't it be great if we were able to give Craig Casey and Balakoon and Timoney good, meaningful game time in Paris and at Twickenham, so they're aware exactly what that experience is like? Because there's a good chance that we're going to need those players in key moments in one of the three or four massive World Cup games that are coming. But if the first time they get those big moments are in Paris against France in a World Cup quarter final, then there's a more chance they're going to fail if they don't have any experience of that before.
Yeah, and again, it's just like you kind of framed the question at the beginning, like, what is the goal? Is it positioning out of Six Nations? I mean, there are a few, if you tell them officially, they'll say it's both, or it's, or is it World Cup quarterfinal stage? I think yes and no, because as well, we've had a slight change in the guard. Like, let's say you're talking about Nick Timoney, like CJ Sanders gone. So as much as Jack Conan has all of a sudden come out and has become our out now first choice number eight up until probably, was it halfway through last season, or not even, maybe just excuse me, after he was selected for the Lions and then started for the Lions, we probably didn't know exactly who was going to be in that position. So I'm not sure how many times Jack Bone has gone and started away at Twickenham and away in France, and does he need that level of exposure just as much as Nick Timoney does, when he probably is going to be the starting, if we had to pick a team now, he's going to be the guy who's starting in a World Cup. Obviously so much changes in 2 years. So I think it might be more a case of, okay, if a guy's out of form a little bit who was a guaranteed starter, if he's after picking up a knock, now we know these guys are there ready to step up. But I wouldn't necessarily rotate for those games, because you still need your best players exposed to those challenges year in and year out. And like Six Nations, as much as our June tour is very important and our November test very important and our club rugby and our European Cup are, like, away to France and England are going to be the two biggest games of the year. They're going to carry the most weight for next season. So you still want your best guys exposed to that and getting used to playing with each other as well. Like, I think that was another reason he kind of didn't want to change the pack too much. And the thing is, we don't have, like, even the fact Andrew Porter now has gone, Toulouse said, and we've Ronan Keller in there. These aren't guys with 30 caps in their position either. So I think we do need to, I've had a really good November series, but now we're going to see something different with them, so they need to continue to work on their balance. And like, do we know where our best second row necessarily is either? Henderson obviously has had a few injuries since coming back from the, well, he did the rest from the Lions and then picked up injuries, so is it Ryan Byrne? And then when you've guys like a phenomenal freak like Ryan Baird breathing down their neck as well, I think these guys are going to be wanting their own game time against this French and English, those games particularly. Yeah.
Bundiaki's 31. He'll be 33 the time World Cup rolls around. That's fine, isn't it? 33 is the kind of outer limit, but anything after that, with the exception of Sexton, where like the age profile is reasonable, I suppose, is the point I'm making, that there's nobody really you can see being shunted out of the team.
No, I suppose Keith Earls is 34 now, but I mean, from listening to obviously his incredible interviews recently, like, he says he's as fast now as he was back then, and I wouldn't rule out that he'll still be there. But I think his role, as we can see even in the November test series, might be changing a little bit. But I wouldn't say Earls definitely gone because he'd be 36. I just think the type of person and player he is, and the fact that he's such a utility cover now, I wouldn't rule him out. But after, besides Earls and Sexton, I think, yeah, you're probably looking at that age profile, right?
I guess it then comes down to when some of those guys need rest, Louise, as opposed to when the management staff actually want to rotate. And if you're looking at the rhythm of the season, it may actually come down to that tour in New Zealand next summer, where a couple of those guys may be rested, even though it's probably one of the toughest places, if not the toughest place to go in rugby.
Yeah, maybe that's where the likes of Craig Casey gets his tour time, or Brian Baird, or, you know, Dan Sheen, that they get more exposed to these top level guys, because you can move the damn sure Kiwis are going to be absolutely baying for us down there. So that's where maybe you get more of your opportunity to try and blood these guys a little bit more. But it's very difficult to say, obviously, now, because it completely depends on how the season goes. But, you know, if Johnny Sexton's still going well, he's not going to put his hand up and say, you know, I'm okay for the June series this year when they're going down to New Zealand. I mean, fair enough, last summer it was, you know, Japan and the USA. It was definitely a good opportunity to bring in some of the fringe players and see what they're like in international duty. But, you know, there's not a lot of guys going to be putting their hand down for this tour.
What do you want to see from Carberry then over the course of the next few weeks in particular? If we forget about the Six Nations and what he's going to do in the Ireland shirt, there was questions not only about him on the international level, but actually about a starting team in Munster over the past couple of months. So what does he need to do to kick on from a pretty successful November over the short term?
Yeah, I think he kicked pretty well, which even his start of the season with Munster, he wasn't as reliant off the boot maybe as he'd like to have been. Definitely seemed a bit ring rusty. Like, you wouldn't say Carberry was necessarily picked on form for his form against Munster, but more on what we know he can achieve, and kind of had that asterisk of knowing he has been carrying injuries and probably needed a little bit more game time as well to get up to speed. So I think it's to bring that Irish form and that confidence. Like, he looked confident the last day, he looked heads up. I actually thought his defence is really good as well. Argentina tried to run up over the top of him a few times off a few lineouts, and you know, fair enough, he had a back row coming in, usually, you know, Van der Fleer and Mahoney to help him out, but he was making his first up tackle. Might be sitting him back in their backside, but
the technique was good though.
It's not a soaked tackle. I think he made 8 tackles in total in the game, and he looked pretty robust as well. Like, he didn't look like at any stage, you know, I don't think he ever got any attention, medical attention during the game. And cool to see him going to fullback as well, just so we're having an idea, having a look at that kind of second playmaker role. So I think with Munster, it's just to actually bring that confidence back in. Hopefully he'll have quite a strong pack in front of him as well that are pushing on. But I suppose on the flip side, if he isn't, how he manages those sorts of games as well. But it's good to see, like, he's kicking out of hand, his identification of space, that was definitely up. Once or twice he took it to the line, he identified that, you know, there's two forwards in front of him, glided through a gap, the show and go. So we saw a lot of the tricks that we're used to seeing from Joey, along with the solid consistency that we want from our 10. So I think just to bring that form back to Munster, and probably even to bring a little bit of leadership with them as well, because suppose when you're coming back from injury and you've had a couple of injuries back to back over the years and you've been away then international duty, mightn't be as hard for, even if you're an international player, to boss your provincial team around. But he really wants him to come back and kind of take ownership and boss Munster around the park now, and just, even, you know, be solid when he needs to be solid, and really back to expressing himself, because that was his point of difference when he first burst onto the scene, is that he could play this really nice running game. He took the ball to the line, he identified space, he did all these other things, as opposed to maybe someone who's really solid, really distributing 10, like a Ross Byrne, who, you know, you could say he's had a hard time of it as well, but it's a completely different type of player. Joey, his point of difference is that kind of running game, that kind of heads up ability to see what's in front of him and just react to it. So I think we're starting to see more of that. So to bring that into Munster definitely would be huge for the province.
Yeah, and now that we've kind of got a good idea of what the Mike Catt attack looks like as a result of what we've seen in November, which of the four provinces most closely resembles that? Like, is Carberry playing for Munster at the moment really good preparation for him when he does put on the green of Ireland again next year?
Yeah, like, I think Munster, like with Larkin as well, it looks like they're trying to play more expansive at times, but I think Leinster is probably the chance to start the question. Like, they're probably the team that most resembles, because they can win it both ways. They can play with a lot of integration of their backs and forwards, and they can play through their pack. Whereas I think with Munster, we're still looking at it. Maybe it's like Anna Farrell last season, where we're kind of wondering, we're getting a lot of positive sound bites, but wondering where we're actually going, where there's a lot of resorting back to box kicking and playing behind her back and playing territory at times. And then there's games where they're excellent, but they've flattered to deceive a little bit at the start of this season as well. So I think Leinster are probably the team that's the most comfortable, and that's because they're have been in that position of being, you know, the best team in the country, one of the best teams in Europe for nigh on 10 years now. So they have that confidence. They have that, I suppose, level of depth within their squad that know how to play that way. But yeah, I think with Joey at the helm, Munster can play a little bit more like that. It's just they need a lot more things to click than just Joey coming back and playing that way.
We should talk about what you think of what's happening in the women's game at the moment. Keir Griffin retiring, obviously, a fellow Kerry woman. She put in one of those all-time great performances that you really want somebody to put in at the end of a career. She's 27, and it seems like a shame for Irish rugby that somebody that young is being lost to the game. And it seems lost to the game, like, you know, there's no set plan. She hasn't announced what she's going to do next. You feel like if everything was going well, the IRFU would have stepped in somehow to make sure that their totemic leader was somehow being kept around. And it just feels like something is wrong at the moment with Irish women's rugby.
Yeah, look, first on junior, she's phenomenal. Phenomenal athlete, phenomenal leader in person. And to be honest, I was at the game last day, and it's rare I've seen a rugby game so influenced by one person. There was a bit of red card from, you know, 30 minutes into the game, 12-3 down against not a fantastic Japanese team. We're obviously struggling for form, for performance. I know we got two results over this window, but that's literally what we got, was two results, not two necessarily performances. And it was kind of a strange, almost like a purgatory, knowing Adam Griggs is still there and Greg McWilliams is sitting in the stand. But what Junior did was phenomenal. I know a lot of people say, oh, she scored two tries, but it's actually all over the field. Her defence, her attack was, if you saw a Japanese player being driven back, her scrum crap popped up. She was just hell-bent on putting her, a massive performance in, and she was phenomenal. So I'm delighted for her with that. I think it was always her plan to retire after the World Cup, and obviously when that didn't happen, she had to reassess. And look, it's difficult. Obviously, you know, there's a lot of talk about amateurism versus professionalism. The squad are in camps a lot, which is always obviously based up in Abbottstown. And with COVID as well, it's so difficult for Cuban to work as a primary teacher in Tralee with bubbles. And, you know, she's got a marriage, building a house. It's just, and she's such an all or nothing person. I can see why you look at it and say, this is physically impossible to spend so much of my time up and down the road to Dublin, when actually I want to start being at home a little bit more, and I've given an awful lot of my time. And the other thing is at rugby, I see a lot of people retire through injury, and she's in such an abrasive player in one of those positions. It's pretty good that she can walk out of it in her own terms as well, and after such a fantastic performance. I suppose one side of it is, you know, you can have all the best fans to retire, and if things are going well and if you're particularly happy and the setup is good and the squad are in a good place and you are that age and you can keep going, that's when, you know, minds get changed. But that wasn't the case. So I do think, you know, what's happened over the last few weeks hasn't had maybe a direct impact in that her decision was made. But if things were on the flip side much better, we all know, as whatever sport you're playing, like, I'll give it one more year, I'll give it another year, because I'm enjoying it so much. So yeah, I suppose that's what I'd say about that. And that's not coming from Junior at all. This is more kind of my own kind of thoughts on it, that, you know, if you're about to retire and you're like, but actually I can never go back, really, this is as good as it gets, and I can manage to go one way, or the body can. But if you have a decision made and there's nothing there to really change your mind, then, you know, it is sad that way.
Yeah.
Listen, she owes the jersey absolutely nothing, that's for sure. She certainly, you know, there's a bit of a cliche, leaving in a better place, but, you know, if ever someone has done it, it's Junior.
Your perspective on this is really interesting, because you came into the setup through the sevens, having watched the success of the 15s team, and then ultimately end up joining the 15s team as well. Did we just go about things the wrong way? Was there an original sin in separating the sevens and the 15s and kind of having a twin track approach and almost separating those two groups? Or was that the only available option for the IRFU, it just hasn't worked out for whatever reason. What's your instinct about where we are now, and what seeds of this, when were they sown?
Yeah, look, I think the original separation was done back in about 2013 when I believe John Scurr would have been managing Sevens, and it would have been around the end of Philip Doyle's time. Well, not the end, he was obviously there 2013, 2014. And there's a separation of sorts, and it was very much coming up to 2014 World Cup, and the 15 squad was going well, but Sevens was kind of getting off the ground. And then Anthony Ada came in as Sevens coach and head director of women's rugby and Sevens rugby around the, I think, December 2015 mark. And following Goose's retirement, Tom Tierney came in, and there was this kind of, I suppose, you know, this idea that you're contracted for Sevens, so that you are paid not an awful lot, but you know, and for that as well, you have to move up to Dublin and leave whatever job and life you have, for whatever part of Ireland you live. And the ultimate goal was to qualify for the Olympics, and then you've been and qualified to get as a core team in the World Series. I need Sevens World Cup as well. So it was a pretty full-on calendar once you're on all those tickets. And I suppose there were players that were always crossing over and back along. I think even to take a step back, there are some people saying if you play Sevens, you shouldn't play 15s and vice versa. Every country in the world is doing it. So I don't agree with that for one second. England brought four players back in from the GB squad to play in the November International Series, and they don't necessarily need them. We could see how dominant they are. But it's how you do it that's important. And actually, coming up to this window, it was done the best because there was no Sevens games. Actually, the first World Series is on this weekend against Dubai since January 2020. So the girls that were, I suppose, spearheaded to be involved or earmarked, they have been in for the last year or so, apart from, I think, Lucy Mulhall was brought in a bit later for whatever reason. I'm not really sure why, to be honest. She'd been brought in earlier. So they were actually fully immersed. And when, you know, the squad, when players are brought up against each other, a lot of them were selected. I don't think the answer to Ireland's problems is that Sevens players are being selected. I think they do need to be immersed as much as possible, both within the club game and within the 15 squad as earlier as possible. And that is happening more than it happened a few years ago. But the 15s international girls also need to be immersed more in the club game. They don't play enough club games. They're not released. There's this idea that obviously the national squad is elite. And this is prior to COVID. Because COVID does add another layer because you're talking about bubbles, etc. But even prior to COVID, they weren't released enough, which meant the club game was suffering. You don't have as much strength and depth for someone who is playing with whatever club. It's very difficult to measure yourself up against the international standard because you don't see the international players right at any stage, and there becomes more and more of a gap. So that's definitely an issue. And I think just that the club in general needs more resources, because since COVID has happened, if you weren't on that kind of circle of the international squad, the 15 squad, and they needed an extra player to pick from because either the 15 players out of form or was injured, they'd no option but to go into the Sevens squad because no one else is training or playing. The intros had started up, but that was too late. That was too close to the September window. And again, the fact that was set up that way just shows that it was never really set up as a feeder into the international squad. So I do think now, I'm not sure, I think Greg McWilliams' first camp might be around January time because our Six Nations happening in a later window. I think we need to see all those players that are playing the last two games back playing with their clubs, almost to obviously raise the standard within the club system, and also that he's a carte blanche to pick from across that whole structure. And as much as possible, they should be released back, because as much as the England women are professional, that's not why they're so good. It's a reason, but it's because of the investment back through the years, through the club game, through having an under 20 side. It's the development pathways. They're all linked with, you know, they're all teams like Saracens, Gloucester, they're all linked with, you know, professional men's clubs. And I know it's a different setup here with the provincial system, but we don't necessarily want to just copy what men do. We need to do a lot more kind of market research into what's going to work for a women's model. But certainly just A, making the senior team professional, or B, separating completely 7s and 15s and saying you can only play at one or the other are not the answer. That they still need to work together. But we definitely need a lot more investment and a lot more, I suppose, genuine people who give a crap about the club game and to try and just develop that as much as possible, that you're closing that gap at Interpros International, and that there's actually a pathway to see. Because otherwise, if I was 17, 18, 19, playing Gaelic football, which is, you know, thriving so much, soccer is coming up, other sports, and I'm playing rugby as well, like, one of the reasons I left basketball to play rugby and Gaelic football is that there was no international senior team. So girls do start to look up along, going, well, what's my goal here?
Yeah.
And if my goal here is, well, I don't even know how to make that team, I never even see those players, then you'll start to hemorrhage more and more players at that crucial stage where they're like sponges and should be developed more and more than 17, 18, 19 years of age.
Yeah, it is definitely important to have that pathway, and maybe that comes out in the review. We'll see the bit of the review that we'll get to see anyway. Louise, great to have you with us again. Thanks a million. Cheers.
Cheers, lad.
Louise Galvin, give us her thoughts there. Of course, played for the 17, played for the 15th, played basketball under 21 for Ireland, played football for Kerry. Not bad. Not a bad CV.
Yeah, pretty good. Really interesting stuff there at the end, actually, because it does seem that there is a couple of potential silver bullet ideas out there that come up every now and again, and clearly that's not the reason. And like, be interested to kind of hear a little bit more about that England situation as well, because we often point to them and say they're professional, that's why they're so good, but actually there are a hell of a lot more reasons. And maybe the lack of a thriving club game in men's rugby right now is actually having a knock-on impact on the women's game as well in some way or another. But yeah, it's really interesting to listen to her break it all down.
OTB AM
with Gillette, proud supporters of Movember. Gentlemen, let's move.